Welcome to Upahamu Africa, a podcast about life and politics on the African continent. I'm Kimmy Dion, one of your hosts, here with my co-host, Rachel Beatty-Riedel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Kim, and hello to our listeners. I think we have a really interesting conversation this week lined up for you with Joseph Muturi, who's the president of Slum Dwellers International. He's based in Nairobi, and he works also as a social and climate activist in Kenya. And we talk urban politics, and we have some really wonderful takeaways from him about life in the city, thinking about what urban politics and urbanicity means, and what de-schooling is in terms of his work in communities, community engagement, around thinking with and like community. So I hope that's of great interest to our listeners. Now, Kim, this has been a really busy week, news-wise, with the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit and the World Cup. So what are some of your takeaways?
Right. So let's start with the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. So this is a three-day summit that's been happening in Washington, D.C. this week, where African leaders have come, you know, to meet with officials from the Biden administration to kind of talk about U.S.-Africa relations. And I want to direct our listeners to work that's been done by Afrobarometer, right? This is the Pan-African Research Network that collects nationally representative survey data from over three dozen African countries. They've put out a lot of great information this week coinciding with the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. And I like what they're doing because, you know, this is a leaders summit, but they're asking us to consider not just what African leaders might want, but what their citizens would prioritize, you know, were they asked to be at the table. For example, on Friday, they tweeted out an infographic highlighting African views of the U.S. and China. And I think this is, you know, I'm not typically a fan of these kind of conversations about like who's winning like African hearts and minds. Is it the U.S. beating out China and like where's Russia and all of this? But I do think this infographic is really interesting because on average across the 20 African countries that were surveyed in 2021 and 2022, 47% of citizens say the economic and political influence of the U.S. in their country is positive, and slightly more, 49% say the same about China's influence. Now, I want our listeners to actually take a look at that infographic when they have the chance. Go to the Afrobarometer Twitter feed, because you'll see there is important variation across African countries for which there's already data, right? Like there's really high perceived positive influence among Beninois, right? So in Benin, it's, you know, 70% of Beninois surveyed said, you know, they had a positive, that the U.S. has a positive influence, compared to 77% saying the same about China. So, but then of course, like you look at a place like Malawi, where, you know, where I do a lot of work, and only 35% say that the U.S. has a positive influence, and 31% say the same about China. So, you know, take a look at that. I had also mentioned in last week's episode, I believe, that Afrobarometer CEO Joe Asumka and Michigan State professor Carolyn Logan, alongside head of publications Brian Howard, wrote a piece using Afrobarometer data that we published in the Monkey Cage. And that was titled, "What Do Africans Want? Afrobarometer Surveys Reveal the Top Concerns." Now, in that piece, they draw on that same tranche of data from the 20 African countries for which survey data from 2020 and 2021 are ready for analysis. And they note that Africans' top concerns, perhaps not surprising to our listeners, are unemployment and government economic mismanagement. They also report that citizens support African countries' pandemic responses, but have doubts about COVID vaccines. And they find that there's significant popular support for government action to address climate change, right? It's a serious issue on the continent. I think more people are affected in their everyday lives by climate change in, you know, various regions of Africa. And so it's really important that it's not just something that activists care about, but we're seeing this kind of broader trend among citizens. Perhaps most importantly for our listeners, Afrobarometer's new findings confirm the continued desire of Africans to live under governments that are democratic, accountable, and responsive. So, you know, kind of that's the citizen perspective. But I know, Rachel, that you've been following the summit closely. And I wonder if you could share what you think are the major takeaways or the importance of this summit happening this week.
Absolutely, Kim. I mean, what you say in terms of the Afrobarometer findings on, you know, citizens' priorities really dovetails well with the cornerstones of what this summit is meant to accomplish. And I think that is a good sign. It bodes well for something productive to come out of this summit that is enhancing U.S. Continental relations. And I think it's informed by the cornerstones of the U.S.'s current Africa policy, which has been shaped by our good friend and former guest on the pod, Judd Devermont. And these are really some of the main issues that are being taken up by all sides, all parties in the summit. And the first, I'll say there are, I'm going to summarize them as three, right? The first is that the goal is to interact as mutually beneficial exchange partners, right? That we have shared interests for U.S. policy, for AU policy, for African individual country policy around health, wealth, and democratic accountability. And this is exactly what you were just referring to, Kim. Michelle Gavin just pointed out from the Council on Foreign Relations just pointed out that the AU is coming to the summit with a list of kind of concrete and actionable interests or points. One is debt relief. Another is intellectual property laws around waiving intellectual property laws so that they can manufacture vaccines, right? And perhaps increase some of that confidence and ideas among citizen around where the vaccines are coming from and how accessible they are. And this kind of approach around what I, you know, kind of think health, wealth, and accountability is really in line with building infrastructure, healthcare resiliency, right? We know that following this, in the wake of this pandemic, we are intimately linked at a global level in terms of health and safety. And so this approach is really going to support economic recovery from the pandemic, as well as running through programs like the Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment, which focuses on healthcare infrastructure. And it's really meant to be a kind of rival to China's Belt and Road Initiative. The second major pillar is about encouraging fair and open societies and democracies. So here is, again, you know, pointing to the Afrobarometer priorities, and this is to support checks and balances on investigative journalists, the independence of the judiciary, encouraging transparency, combating corruption, addressing misinformation and disinformation. These are topics that some of our non-resident fellows have taken up over the last few years. And these are global challenges, global priorities that we face in the U.S. and, again, are connected in terms of interests on the continent and U.S. So a focus on open societies that are more likely to share common goals and can counter some of what we might see as concerning activities by Russia on the continent with the increasing presence of the Wagner Group and the like. The third pillar is really around energy transition. So here, focusing on climate resilient infrastructure, climate adaptation efforts, and conserving ecosystems, really trying to serve as a bulwark against the negative climate impacts that we're seeing in terms of increasingly catastrophic or shocking weather events. We see that in the U.S. We see that in many places, coastal regions in Africa, drought, et cetera. And so the strategy really supports green energy programs as an avenue to meet growing energy demands on the continent and shifting demands across the world, right, related to the war in Ukraine and the way in which Africa's resources have been pulled around that. So really important elements of those cornerstones of U.S. policy that seem to link up with citizen demand. And so I think that's promising. And then the second just key point that I want to highlight is the shifting nature of geopolitics that we have to recognize. The U.S. is certainly not the sole or the main focal point for African countries whose leaders are here for the summit. There are many actors. They're competing for influence, they're competing for resources, but they're also competing for partnership. And it's with that mindset of a partnership that can really address diplomacy, democracy, development, and defense. And I just want to say one thing about defense, which is the need for the recognition of peace and stability for citizens anywhere and everywhere to thrive and exchange, right? So to address the development sides, to address the democracy sides, we know that security assistance has been done wrong for many decades, not only by the US, but by the French, which is case in point of the French pulling out of Mali. That public discontent over security drives more conflict, right? And that civilian stakeholders really need to inform security policy as well as economic priorities. So this, I think, is a new approach. I think it's really taken up in the US-Africa policy approach, and I think it can make for some hopefully very productive conversations at this summit.
There's so much in that, Rachel, and there's a few threads I kind of want to pull on a little bit. So for example, you know, talking about security, I remember we published something in the Monkey Cage in the last year by a doctoral student in the UK, kind of talking about actually, the presence of European soldiers can actually lead African citizens to feel insecure. And I believe she did her research in Niger, right? So kind of talking about, because it's not just the presence of those soldiers, but like what reaction the presence of those soldiers give to, groups that are trying to maintain their security, including insurgent groups. But another thread that I wanted to kind of pull on was, you know, when you were just talking in the beginning about the AU being there, right? The AU, the African Union, I actually didn't know they were there. So like glad to know, right? This is why I'm so glad we have these conversations, because I learn things, you know, as well. You know, it's not just listeners who learn things in the news wrap. But of course they're there. Because, you know, it's not just about bilateral relationships, right, between, say, the U.S. and Nigeria or the U.S. and Cameroon, right, that there's also these kind of super regional bodies, right, like the African Union that is, you know, working in the interests of African citizens more broadly. Likewise, you know, ECOWAS, I imagine, probably sent a representative there. And so when you were talking about that, it was reminding me of Emmanuel Balogun. And as I mentioned, you know, the interview I did with him about his book and about this kind of ECOWAS security force, this new thing that African ECOWAS heads of state have suggested is necessary to maintain constitutional order. You know, that has been published and is live on the Monkey Cage. I know that Emmanuel, and you're also talking about partnership, right? Which I think is really key. And I know that this is something that's been important to Judd Devermond, but also Travis Atkins and Emmanuel Balogun, right? These three people who we've featured on the show, right? Like you interviewed Emmanuel, we did the mashup with Judd and Travis like so many moons ago, and we did another mashup with Judd, you know, these friends of the podcast, like this is something they've been saying forever. This is the only way they're thinking about Africa. And all three of these people are at this summit. And I think that's so important because I want the Americans representing American interests, thinking about Africa, not as a place of extraction, which I think, you know, has been a dominant narrative in, you know, the last couple of centuries, but as a place for partnership. And to think about these kind of, as you're saying, right, that this link that we have. And I know, you know, I've been so impressed with the way Judd talks, for example, you know, this week's interview is about cities. Judd talks about in American cities, the significant presence of African migrants. And so that we have these ties to the continent just based on the citizens living in American cities and, you know, what that contributes. And I love the fact that, you know, these guys are all at, you know, this summit. And I hope that, you know, people of influence are listening to them because these are longstanding for them, I should say, you know, them and potentially others, but ways of thinking about Africa, not as a place of extraction, but as a place to partner.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's such an important takeaway and, you know, as a basis of policy that shapes everything coming from it. And then you can really see that there's real room for mutually beneficial exchange.
Right. And also at the summit, I saw, you know, I think Afrobarometer CEO Joe Asuka is at the summit. He sent a kind of a photo and a tweet on Tuesday, you know, the first day of the summit, about Botswana's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Honorable Dr. Lemogang Kwape. And it was in Kwape's statement, he was referencing Afrobarometer as one of the institutions that his government consulted in the lead up to decriminalizing same-sex relations in Botswana. So for our listeners who don't know, less than a year after Botswana's President Mokgweetsi Masisi publicly expressed support for the LGBTQ community, saying in 2018, quote, "Just like other citizens, they deserve to have their rights protected." It was, you know, just within a year, Botswana's High Court unanimously ruled to strike down two colonial era laws that criminalize same-sex acts. Now, analyst Glenda Muzenda noted in a 2017 report that there was increased tolerance among some religious leaders in the years just prior to the court's decision, although leaders had made no public declaration of support for the LGBT community. She was kind of noting this on the ground. And again, like, this is reminding me of another thread, Rachel, of what you were talking about, and that's about rights, but also about the need for an independence among courts, you know. And, you know, just thinking through, you know, in my own work with University of Malawi political scientist and two-time guest on the show, Boniface Dulani, we examined decades of public opinion data, including Afrobarometer data, but also World Value Survey data and data from the Pew Global Attitudes Project for an article that was published in the Oxford Research Encyclopedia on LGBTQ rights and politics. And it was drawing on lessons from that research on sexual minorities in Africa, that the decriminalization, like what we saw recently in Botswana, but also in other countries like in Mozambique, may actually lead to more tolerant public attitudes. So it's a welcome move, right? Kind of hearing this from Botswana, that you know, this leadership on tolerance, it's a welcome move, because that leadership showing tolerance could actually lead to a more tolerant public. Mm-hmm. And if we think about rights, you know, maybe we need a little bit of leadership.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Which, you know, is also a moment relating back to the U.S. context in terms of Biden signing into law same-sex rights in the United States. And so these are global questions, right? And we are looking across countries and finding places for rights and tolerance and inclusion. Kim, I wanted to give our listeners a quick update from last week, our conversation about South Africa and the impending vote to potentially push out President Cyril Ramaphosa in terms of an impeachment vote concerning these allegations of graft and corruption. So this week we have new news and update that the African National Congress Party, Ramaphosa's party, helped block that impeachment bid. So that will not be moving forward in terms of technical impeachment charges against Ramaphosa. Kim, the other topic we were very excited about last week was the World Cup, and Morocco now will face off against Croatia for the third place match this Saturday, so on the day of our release. What are your takeaways from the World Cup this year and Morocco's success thus far? What are you thinking?
Well, I have to say, I was a little bit sad during the Morocco-France game, obviously. But I have to, you know, so I'm trying to, like, figure out, like, all the ways, like, to make myself feel better. One, they do get to play for the third place position, right? So there's that game on Saturday. And obviously, we are rooting for Morocco over Croatia. So there's that. And two, you know, they lost to the reigning champs, the French.
Yeah.
Right. Mbappe. And, like, let's be honest, the French team is pretty African. So, like, if there's a team they have to lose to, right? So now, obviously, we are all rooting for France, because, like, at least if Morocco's not going to win the World Cup, I want them to have not won because they lost to the winners.
Exactly.
And also for, like, all the Africans on the French team, I would like for them to win. So this is like, I don't know, maybe this is like, I'm in the bargaining phase of my denial. I'm not sure. Anyways, who cares? Like, I'm more interested in watching the Morocco Croatia game. And I don't know if our listeners have seen it yet, but I really hope that they've read, you know, this long read by Hisham Aidi in, Africa as a Country called The African Arab Cup. And African is in parens. And it's really kind of, seeing the Moroccan team, but also kind of Morocco's presence in the World Cup as forging a new dissident third world solidarity. And in this piece, he also talks kind of more specifically about Moroccan identity and how it's both Arab and African, but also how it's Amazigh, and kind of talking about, you know, in particular, I think, if you're not familiar with identity in Morocco, I think it's a great primer for you to read. And, you know, for example, just understanding, like, what is Amazigh? Like, is it not okay to say Berber anymore? You know, like, I think that reading this essay that Hisham has written will really teach you more about that. And I don't think it answers all of people's questions, but I do think that it enlightens us, and it makes us think, and it makes us wonder. And I think that that's good and important. And I think, especially as, you know, you and I, we kind of, in our graduate training, you know, there was this focus, like if you studied Africa, you studied, quote, sub-Saharan Africa. But it's, you know, it's in the time, you know, I think that we've been professors kind of going through this whole like tenure rat race where, you know, I feel like the field of political science is trying to shift. And I think even, you know, within kind of, you know, others who have been trained in North America and Europe to really trouble that Sahelian boundary, right? Saying like, oh, the Saharan desert is like people who were above that get studied by MENA scholars, right? Middle East, North Africa scholars, and people below that, we study, quote, sub-Saharan Africa. And I say sub-Saharan Africa in quotes, because I try actually not to use that phrase anymore because of, you know, just kind of the connotations of like, what does it mean to be sub? Mm-hmm. And, you know, is there, and like, what does this line even mean? And some of that, I think, came through for me when I was first reading drafts of Adam Branch and Zachariah Montpelli's book. And Hisham, in his essay, invokes that book in talking about, like, people wanted to talk about the Arab Spring, but those revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt, those were happening on the African continent. It was an African Spring. Mm-hmm. And there were connections across that Saharan divide. And I just love that this Moroccan team is pushing us to remember Morocco is in Africa. They are an African team. And I don't know if you know this, Rachel, but Morocco is the first country to recognize the US when it declared independence from the British. And I just, you know, again, going back to this U.S.-Africa Leader Summit, like if we think about U.S.-African foreign relations, mm-hmm. let's go all the way back.
Exactly.
You know, who was the first to recognize the U.S.? It was an African country, mm-hmm. right? So like if you like, you know, there's something important and meaningful about U.S.-African relations. And I hope you know, as we see the end of the summit, but also as we, you know, root for Morocco in this match against Croatia, that we think about how we connect to other people in the world and how we're linked, as you're saying, you know, and what we're doing to respect and dignify mm-hmm. those connections and links.
I love that, Kim. So well said. So we'll be watching Saturday with hope in our hearts and really thinking about, you know, all of the multifaceted contexts that this world provides in terms of connection. So now please take a listen to my conversation with Joseph Maturi. Thanks so much for being with us on this episode of Ufahamu Africa. Here today, I am with Joseph Muturi, who is the president of Slum Dwellers International, a network of community-based organizations of the urban poor in 32 countries across Africa, Asia, and Latin America. He's a social activist and a leader of the organization Mugano wa Wanavijiji. All right. And which is the National Federation of Slum Dwellers and the largest social movement in Kenya. Now, Muturi has worked extensively on projects that affect urban poor communities in Kenya, engaging with donor agencies and academia to build strong relationships with residents, including in the Mukuru Special Planning Area project, one of the largest informal settlement upgrading projects ever planned. Muturi has helped communities to build consensus on strategy, budgeting, planning, and implementation of projects, and he has also been a climate change activist and resilience champion. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. Just one correction, it's not past tense, I'm still in the climate change, I'm still a climate change activist,
very strong.
And second, thanks for having me. I think on behalf of SDI, it's an honor and privilege to be part of the processes in this historical institution.
Wonderful. We're so glad to have you here at
Thank
Cornell.
You very much. Yeah.
And in particular, we're lucky to have Joe with us today as part of the university's Muiho Center for Cities Launch Symposium, which is a center for cities, and they're focusing the symposium on critical conversations for urban transformation. And that's organized by the inaugural director, Victoria Beard. So we're thankful that you're here with us. And just on the heels, if I am correct, of attending the United Nations General Assembly meetings and some climate meetings there.
Yes, I had a number of climate meetings. I had an invitation from the Blue Bug Philanthropies. I had another meeting with the Resilience Champions. So I was running from this meeting to the next meeting.
Perfect. So we're going to get all of your summaries of the current state of conversations.
Okay.
So I wanted to start out with you, Joe, in terms of talking about urbanness and urbanicity, right?
Okay.
Because so for this podcast, for our listeners, we're, you know, focused on life and politics on the African continent. And when we speak of those things, so often we're referencing these huge demographic changes that we're hearing about, you know, people moving to the cities, the rate of urbanization is increasing, the total number of urban residents is increasing. And I think we have estimates now, the 2021 World Bank estimates are about 42% of the population is urban in sub-Saharan Africa. And we know that that will be continuing to increase. So I'm wondering if you can tell us at the broad level, what is underlying these trends that you're seeing? What, you know, if you can unpack urbanization for us from your perspective, what you're seeing in terms of informal settlements, who is moving to the city and why? You know, is it the kind of conventional wisdom of agricultural households sending some of their people to the city? Or is it that, you know, places are becoming more and more urban as population increases right there? What do these trends tell us about what's really happening?
Thank you very much for the question. And I think it's a combination of very many, and the slums are very dynamic, very different. I think some of them are just the historical challenges that we used to have, where most African countries, at the advent of independence, everything was centralized to the city. If you wanted the good jobs or the factories or the manufacturing were in the big cities, the schools, secondary schools, the universities were, and people moved to the cities in terms of looking for these opportunities, looking for these services if you wanted an ID. And we have the other lot that came, and still today we have this we call economic migrants. These are people where they come from, the rural, the agriculture sector somehow died. If you look, for example, in my country, Kenya, the cotton industry died, the pyrethrum industry died. So it led to a shutting down of many factories in the rural areas. And I think, again, I will talk about later. So we have all these people coming to look for opportunities, employment opportunities in Nairobi. Then we have this new phenomena now with climate change. There is are not predictable. Farmers nowadays, farming is not as lucrative as it used to be. Farming does not provide livelihoods as it used to be. So people are packing up and moving back to the city.
Yes.
So we have a combination of a lot of things. But part also is that even our slums are growing.
Yes.
The population within our slums are growing. So
Mm-hmm.
if you ask me, Kibera, Mukuru, most of the slums in my city, we have now almost third, fourth generation families.
Yes.
So their grandfather immigrated a long time ago, settled. He didn't have anywhere else to go. He had children, the children have children, so the population in these informal settlements are increasing. So if you go to places like Kibera, like Mukuru, they are now building upwards. They are building multi-story corrugated iron, zinc, iron sheet housing. So it's a mixture of many. And I don't think the other thing is that the lack of I can't call it the lack of awareness, like the lack of interests from the national city government that addressing this, because these challenges, they knew they were there. They have been told 100 times, if you don't do something now, this is going to happen.
Yes.
It has already put a strain in already constrained resources and services. There isn't enough. The government is not, the cities and governments are not doing enough housing. They have not increased the service delivery. The source of water is the same. They are not looking at other sources of water. The transport infrastructure is the same that was left by the British 50 years ago. So it's a, you are looking at these things. So these are things that in some areas deliberately or intentionally are being left like that.
Yes.
Because number one, if you talk about politics, informal settlements are vote banks.
Yes.
This is where you get populations. Kibera, they talk about 1 million, which is not true. In Mukuru, we are talking about a population of almost 500,000. In Mathare, the same. These are basically hunting grounds for politicians. So
Yes.
intentionally or unintentionally, they are supposed to be, they are being deliberately left like that. Because even the efforts that we are seeing are not, it's very, it depends on the goodwill.
Yes.
They are not actually up to, my federation has been pushing for policies that addresses this question. So they don't see this as a priority.
Yeah.
If you look at our county governments, if you look at the allocation, budgetary allocation for housing department or the urban department or the planning department, is negligible. We have a joke. One of the counties that we are working in, the budget for the count, the count, the governor's entertainment is more than the budget allocated to the Department of Urban.
Wow.
So the priority is samosas and sausages for the governor,
Yeah, exactly.
not services, not delivering services.
Exactly. So let me unpack that a little bit because there are many important things that you've raised here. So first, you said these informal settlements at times can be kind of deliberately left this way because politicians might see them as voter banks. What are the trends that you see in terms of residents, people residing in the informal settlements? Are they voting in the city or are they leaving the city at election time to go back to constituencies that are outside of the city? And does
It's
that
a,
leave a kind of
yeah, it's a
void?
mixture of both, because if you look at my city, the population is now, we are going to 5 million people.
Yes.
If you are looking at almost 3 million people live in informal settlements. If you are looking at the registered voters in the city of Nairobi, it's about, it's around 2 million registered voters. So it's a mixture. We have a negligible number that go back to their rural places to vote. But I think majority of people vote in the city. If you look at the numbers in terms of, for example, a constituency here in Nairobi, the number of voters vis-à-vis the a constituency in the rural areas in central, you see the numbers are quite different. But there are people, yes, who go back to their rural homes to vote. There are people, yes, for different reasons. Some say, I'm just here to work. This is not my home. This is a place that I get to live while I hustle. Eventually, I want to have a decision where I'm going to settle, where my home is.
Right.
Then there are people who go, I think after 2007, the fear of post-electoral violence. There are people who basically run away. So I think this year's elections were different. It was very peaceful. It's being dubbed by the media the most boring election because we didn't fight. We just had one casualty. An officer with the Electoral Commission, but in terms of people clashing, I think also people kind of got fed up, and they realized, I think we have been voting, but we can't see any change. Things are still the same. So there was lack of the motivation, the impetus to go out and vote. Even the voter turnout was so low. They were targeting 70%. It was less than 70%.
Exactly. And so in that way, you're seeing a kind of sizable population who stays in the city. And some do get engaged around political claims, you know, maybe claims that are reflected in the foundation's work, right? Around improving the conditions in the settlement that you've just laid out, water, public services, housing, you know, the regulations, etc., that could potentially really improve. So what do you see as the biggest political concerns or issues driving the residents in informal settlements in Nairobi or more generally?
So I think there have been changes over the last few years. There's a lot of civic education. There's a lot of people being aware of their rights. There's a new generation of young people born in these informal settlements. These are young people, educated, some with university degrees, who know their rights. And they are saying things shouldn't be this way. We deserve better. And I think there are efforts being done by civil society organizations to provide one level of services. You know, with the gaps in the city and the national government, these are spaces where NGOs occupy. But then for people like me, yes, I have organizations in my city that provide water. They have done a hospital. They have done schools. They have done this. And for me, when I'm asked, I usually tell them, you are part of the problem. For people who are working so hard to check the government and to push the government to be accountable to the taxpayers, for people like us who are pushing government to deliver just basic rights, to deliver what they promised. So when you come and you start providing freebies to the community, you are helping the government get off the hook. And this, I'm talking from experience. Some years ago, we had a fund, Muungano had a fund where people used to organize communities. They come, we top up, they go buy land somewhere. And we realized the ministry was telling people, when people go to fight and advocate for their land, the minister was telling them, why don't you go to Muungano? They'll give you money to buy land. So we stopped that. So you're letting. So for me, it's part of the, I look at the challenges of informality. Of urbanization. When there is flooding, there's cholera in Mukuru. The middle class and everybody else, the government, it's those people's problem. How do we make it our problem? COVID taught us how connected we are. COVID did not discriminate that this is a poor people's disease or a rich man's disease. So people, you could have, you have your house girl, your watchman in Mudhaiga, in Kilimani. He lives in Kibera. He takes COVID from you and takes the COVID to Kibera and vice versa. So how we came together, we saw COVID as everybody's problem.
Exactly.
We have to work together. So how do we make the issue of slums and the challenges of slums and informality everybody's problem?
Mm-hmm.
From the slum dwellers, city decision makers, national decision makers, business community, it shouldn't be left to civil society organization or northern NGOs.
Exactly.
Take for example, you have been to Nairobi, you know Kibera.
Mm-hmm.
So the joke in Kibera, everybody knows about Kibera.
Mm-hmm.
The joke in Kibera, for every family, there is an NGO for every family in Kibera.
Right.
But is the situation changing?
Right.
No.
Exactly.
No. Mm-hmm. It's still the same. Everybody doing their little thing and documenting and taking nice pictures of their little project, the water tap there, this.
Mm-hmm.
No. Why don't we bring all these resources, all our ideas, all our skills, and actually support the city or the national government to deliver?
Exactly. So you really see the need for the national government and the municipal government to have a strategic plan. Right, a kind of an implementable plan for
exactly.
the city, for the
everybody,
future of the city.
Everybody has their plan,
mm-hmm.
and they are not delivered.
Right.
The country, the national government has their slum upgrading program.
Mm-hmm.
County government have their county integrated development plans.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find that the counties want to do 2,000 houses.
Yes.
National governments are very ambitious.
Yes.
They want to do 200,000 houses in a year.
Yes.
Which you have, none of them have absolutely delivered.
Nothing. Mm.
So why don't we bring these efforts together?
Mm-hmm.
So we are looking at, so when we talk about the challenges of climate change,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of backpassing.
Yes.
Where
mm-hmm.
you talk to county governments, they will tell you, no, this money, the national government has money. They are getting a lot of money from the Green Climate Fund. They got billions to deal with these challenges. So that is not our problem.
That's right.
But more and more people are appreciating devolution.
Mm-hmm.
More and more people are appreciating that whatever needs to change has to be done from the ground.
Exactly.
When you talk about housing, there's an appreciation of, let's look at what are these communities doing
mm-hmm.
in terms of addressing housing issue, in terms of addressing services. Why don't we scale up these efforts that they are doing?
Mm-hmm.
Let's not just sit somewhere in a boardroom like this, come up with designs, design new houses, nice. Can we go make communities at the center of the thinking, of the planning, of the dreaming?
Right.
What kind of neighborhoods do they want?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of houses do they want? Mm-hmm. What materials do they want for their houses?
Mm-hmm.
And then we involve them in the design phase.
Yes.
We involve them in the planning phase. And we involve them in the... there's a lack of appreciation and a lack of... in the community participation space. It's mm-hmm. the same attitude. Government knows best.
Right.
Cities knows best. No, we are planners. We went to university, so it's let's involve everybody. And the solutions usually are to be found where the problems are.
Right.
The solutions are not in City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
The solutions are not in Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
The solutions are down there.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you'll find where the problems are. You'll find the solution there.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned the kind of devolution, right?
Mm.
Because the political idea behind devolution is exactly that you're able to get closer to where the solutions reside, where people's needs are, how they vision their futures and their, you know, today. Do you see, because Kenya has been undergoing this extensive devolution, is that happening in Kenya where with the devolution process at the formal level, you're getting closer?
At some level, yes.
Mm-hmm.
You are seeing little bits of, but devolution is working.
Mm-hmm.
But we also devolved other negative things.
Mm-hmm.
We also devolved corruption.
Right.
But we are seeing if it's properly managed, properly implemented, it's... But you can see, especially in the rural areas, you travel, you drive around, going to Kisumu, you will see the small towns now, all of a sudden they are growing.
Mm.
People are investing, building factories in this small town.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Devolution is working, but not at the pace that we want to.
Yes.
We would wish to see.
Yes.
Yes, devolution is working. In terms of also bringing resources at the local level,
mm-hmm.
In some areas, committees deciding what is our priority.
Mm-hmm.
So at a certain level, it's working,
mm-hmm.
it's a mixture, but it's a step towards the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Many of us, yes, we have, we usually say we are overrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
A small country with so many, we have almost 300 members of parliament.
Yes.
We have so many members of the county assemblies.
Mm-hmm.
We have women representatives just to make sure the gender balance. We have county reps. We have senators. We have for what? We ask, so what is the role of the senator? Is to check the county governments.
Mm-hmm.
What is the role of the women reps? So I think we are overrepresented.
Yes.
Yes. And these are the things that probably in the next few years we address. How do we want to be governed?
Yes.
But devolution is working.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you find it, you know, that is the pathway in some respects to really come closer to make government more both accessible and informed by
mm-hmm.
the citizens that are supposed to be represented.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other things that you mentioned is the kind of multi-generational slum, you know, dweller families, right?
Yes,
so you
yes.
have third generation, you have fourth generation families
yeah.
who have been in informal settlements. Do you find that those multi-generational families, they have different concerns or perspectives from new arrivals? You know, somebody who's just come into the city in the last few years. I mean, how does that kind of multi-generational settlement affect the contributions?
They don't. And I think one of my colleagues did a study of, but they were more or less looking at people who are refugees from other countries.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of also the multi-generation families living,
mm-hmm.
their challenges are different.
Yes.
The grandfathers will tell you, here we used to keep goats and cattle and we used to graze them around. Now there's no space.
Uh-huh.
The parents will say, will tell you the history of where the rot began.
Yes.
But the third or fourth generation, this is what they know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
Nowadays, the parents will say, we didn't have problems with water.
Right.
We didn't have problems with insecurity. We used to get services.
Yes.
But the other generation said, we cannot see these things. And when we get them, they're expensive. So we have communities where they have challenges
mm-hmm.
With refugees from outside, because you know Kenya is a host of many refugees from Rwanda, from Congo, Sudan, Somalia, Ethiopia, Eritrea.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, we are a safe haven for refugees.
Yes.
Some of them don't want to stay in camps.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them run away from the camps. They join people, they come, they start. But they are usually welcomed
mm-hmm.
by the
yes.
communities.
Yes.
But just in case they start misbehaving,
mm-hmm.
it leads to tension.
Mm-hmm.
So the friend, the study he was doing, and I can share the report to you, I'll check,
mm-hmm.
is how outsiders treated.
Mm-hmm.
How are these refugees treated?
Mm-hmm.
Like they don't have access to education. They cannot attend our education system
mm-hmm.
because they can't be registered. They don't have a NEMIS number. They cannot access medical because they are all those opportunities that they lack.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That has got nothing to do with the locals. Mm.
And so in that way, you know, you were saying kind of that for those who have been, whose families have been there for a long time, their conditions of living in informal settlement have changed dramatically. And then,
mm-hmm.
you know, the kind of newest, you know, fourth generation, they
mm-hmm.
can't imagine the informal settlement the way that their great grandfathers and grandmothers found it. Do you think the conditions have gotten worse, more challenging?
They are 10 times worse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They are, in terms of the densities have increased,
mm-hmm.
in terms of the services have decreased,
mm-hmm.
More insecurity,
mm-hmm.
Less opportunities, more crime.
Yep.
So they cannot relate to what used to be. Mm-hmm. This is what we know. This is how we found it. Nothing has really, really changed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the problems have multiplied.
Right, with increasing population concentration.
Increased density is always, any increased density, it's already putting a strain to the already restrained resources, restrained services.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So thinking about that condition, you know, that context that you've just laid out for us, what is your ideal, you know, if you could wave a magic wand, what would the future of informal settlements in Kenya be? You know, what would happen? How would it change for the better?
For me, number one, the good place to start is to fight slums, not fight slum dwellers.
Mm-hmm.
A good place to start is to create policies. Very institutional is to create frameworks for slum upgrading, is to create policies for slum upgrading, which is all inclusive, which is leave no one behind kind of approach. With these frameworks, and see to put, to prioritize, to see this as a problem, to prioritize it, and to bring everybody's effort, the planners, architects, civil society organizations, academia. How do we plan for this? We have proved, I will share with you the Mukuru SPA where we brought everybody together. We have 600 acres. Let's consult with the community. How do we plan for this settlement? And we pull it off.
Wow.
We are now, government is putting in infrastructure, it is putting in sewer. So for me, if I was, that is where I start. Create policy, intentionally prioritize the issues of housing, prioritize the issues of bringing in service to informal settlements where the majority of the population lived, and plan. We start with a plan. Let's start with a plan. Let's create a plan. Let's adopt that plan. Let's create the plan with the communities, but let's involve everybody. Let us look at infrastructure, housing, health, schools. Let us look at let the academia help us with how do we look at the standards. Let's change the standards. Let's look at the financing. Where is this money going to come from? Is this money sustainable? Are we going to create a fund that makes sure every year we're providing at least housing for at least 2,000 people every year? Let's make it a law. That is where you start.
You
cannot do everything, but let's have create frameworks for this. Infrastructure, financing, where's the money going to come? Who is going to fund? At what cost? How much are they going to pay? Is it free housing? Is it social housing? What is it? How are we going to connect these informal settlements? How are we going to open up these informal settlements for investments? How are we going to connect these informal settlements to other parts of the city? So slum upgrading does not mean it's upward mobility. When you build somebody a nice house, have you changed the kind of work? If he was selling charcoal, so that now he has a nice brick stone house, does he stop selling charcoal? No. All this, you have to look at the socioeconomic factors have to be considered when you're talking about slum upgrading.
Right, right. And in that way, you know, your answer there kind of leads me to, you know, your earlier comment that really thinking about true improvement of the informal settlements, it has to be connected to a politics of the whole city.
Exactly.
That everyone has to see that as one, you know, that our well-being is connected.
We are part of the city.
Exactly.
We are citizens of this city.
Exactly. So if we take that and extrapolate it another level, what do you think are the politics of the city right now with the kind of increasing, you know, urbanization continues for the very reasons that you've laid out for us. Urban populations are becoming bigger. What do you think are the major factors driving kind of the politics of the city? You know, is it a void because people care about other things and they're not focused on urban governance? Is it a contested space that's very divisive? Like, how do we think about competing interests or lack of interest?
No, so number one, very practically, I'm looking at this election. On the governor we have, We elected a young person to be the governor of this city.
Mm-hmm.
The other one was a joker. He was a populist, very pro-poor, do things for the poor, Escobar style. You provide people with this money, food, but in terms of the changes they want to see,
mm-hmm.
absolutely rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
So the new one was elected on the premise, the way we organized. And I tell you, people are becoming more aware of their rights.
Yes.
Civil society are more active. We are no longer, we don't do politics.
Right.
They are getting into that political space because the challenges of informality is because of politics. It's because of the people we elect and the bad decision-making at City Hall.
Yes.
So a lot of organizations got... So let me tell you what we did, for example. From the ward level... to the county level, who are aspiring to be governors. We organize young people in these informal settlements. What are you, do you think are your key priorities? And they signed the contract with all the aspirants. We did the same up to the governor level. And the governor who we elected, as much as there were party politics to play, he was elected by the party that purportedly spoke for the poor.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And you know, this contest, our contest was dubbed, this was between hustlers and dynasties.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the governor was on that premise, this is the government of hustlers.
Yes.
This is the government of, this is the poor people's government.
Mm-hmm.
He understood, he's young, he understood. He related very well with the young people.
Mm-hmm.
He understood the challenges of informal settlement.
Yes.
And he was very articulate in saying, I know where I will get water. I know you don't have water. I know the waters here are controlled by cartels. And for me, the only way you fight cartels is not to get involved with them from the word go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The other, his guy, other person was a project of the powers that be.
Yes.
So he said me, I owe no one. I'm my own man. I don't want to get... So he understood, he related, and he had solutions to all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So the politics is more of now people are moving away from the incentives, the $1, $2, the T-shirts.
Right.
They are moving from that, and they are becoming more issue-oriented. We
yes.
want a community center.
Yes.
We get water 3 days a week. Sign this.
Mm-hmm.
We are not just going, don't promise us
right.
only. Can you sign this bloody charter?
Right, right, exactly.
Can you put your sign? And we shall hold you accountable.
Mm-hmm.
God forbid that you don't.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You are also a social activist.
Yes.
You know, so you lead citizen mobilization.
Yes.
How do you see the future of social mobilization? You know, are you hopeful because you see this sense of people demanding and claiming their rights?
Very, very hopeful. And for me, I'm encouraged. For me, I am second generation SDI leadership.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I looked around at the young people we have.
Mm-hmm.
For me, getting into this struggle was a struggle that came from experience.
Mm-hmm.
From where I come from.
Yes.
I see my mother's place being evicted. It came from pain.
Yes.
Being this place. But we have another generation we have that came in where things are kind of normal.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of fought and stopped the evictions and forced demolitions.
Mm-hmm.
And I was worried, who are these future activists?
Mm-hmm.
We involved young people in our work. They can collect data, they can map with these apps with their eyes closed. For us, when we were collecting data, we had a 10-page questionnaire.
Yes, yes.
But we did a workshop with 50 young people from the city. And I deliberately said we had some money from the MasterCard Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want young people who have been workshopped.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they see me, they know I talk about land,
mm-hmm.
I talk about housing,
mm-hmm.
I talk about services,
mm-hmm.
I talk about organizing around savings, around data collection. So they will tell me what they think I want.
Yes.
I want you to go to the hard to reach. You know, let me tell you something very funny. You know, there are young people in some areas. They deliberately want to remain anonymous. They are not anywhere in the government records. Mm-hmm. they have not taken an ID because they are afraid their fingerprints will be taken.
Yes.
So they decided to be invisible because of the things they do, probably crime. And these same people knew the problems. Yeah. And the good thing, they are not like our generation of blaming this one or that one or blaming the system or the man at the top of blaming. They understand we are also part of this. There are some things we are to blame for. Like keeping our community clean. You cannot blame City Hall for our community being dirty. Us dumping rubbish in the river. These are not things that us not holding our leaders accountable. So we saw a change. We have a project we are doing called, they did in each of their settlements, they drew something called, and you can check on it on Facebook, the Trees of Transformation. If settlement you go, there's a tree of transformation, clearly identifying the challenges and clearly identifying the solution. So this new generation, I think I'm hopeful. They have set another bar for themselves. We are not going to take handouts. We are going to engage our political leaders, and we are going to engage the, our governance structures on issues and what we want. So we are very, so we are creating another level, a movement of young people. And tell us, how do you want to engage? For me, I organize around daily savings, women cooperatives. I organize around data collections. Those who are my tools. What do you want to engage with? What do you want to use to organize yourselves?
Yes.
How do you tap into that energy?
And they have their own ideas.
They have their own ideas. Now, I have a project which is very personal to me. We in SDI, we have something called the Know Your City. That is the data collection where federations in their country, they have profiled the entire cities. They have up-to-date information about the informal settlements. But then you have a Know Your City TV. These are young people who are being trained in filmmaking, in documentation, writing, blogging, photography. And the idea, it was a tool to mobilize, something cool for them to do. And they loved it. And we get somebody to train them to do these things, a professional to train them. It's continuous. It's continuous training now. They have been trained for the last 6 years. And the idea was to tell the stories about their communities themselves.
Yeah.
Not somebody coming from the New York Times to write and he'll twist it in an angle.
Totally.
They were tired of hearing another sad Kibera story.
Mm-hmm.
It's just flying toilets, crime, violence, dirty, poor housing, blah, 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 blah.
Totally.
They wanted to tell this another side.
Mm-hmm.
We have business people. We are thriving. We have champions.
Yes.
Who we have footballers who are playing this or that. We have models. We have beautiful girls. We have children who are excelling from our slums and going to national schools and doing well, going to university, is to tell the stories themselves as they see.
Yes.
As they live.
Yes, yes, exactly. So we're going to post a link to that Know Your City. That just sounds amazing. And in fact, it's one of the kinds of projects we have, a new set of non-resident fellows that are part of our Ufahamu Africa team, and a couple of them have been based, and now for this year also will be based in Nairobi. So we love to get, you know, the stories as people see it in their everyday lives. So you mentioned that you've worked, you know, you work with academics, you work with government officials, you work with practitioners and planners, along with social movements. For the academics who are out there listening, this is a kind of a favorite question of mine. What are the ideal forms of partnership? You know, how do you make use of partnerships with academics?
So, from my knowledge and from my experience, so we started partnering with academia, with the University of Nairobi.
Yes.
On our data collection tool, there was a logo of Muungano wa Vijiji and there was a logo of University of Nairobi. All of a sudden, people are paying attention to this data.
Oh,
that is the value
yes.
that academia added to our processes.
Interesting. So in some senses, it's a kind of...
It's kind of legitimized the data that we have collected.
Yes, exactly. You get. Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
The other thing, and for people listening, for the partnerships that we seek, we have different people coming to informal settlements to do research. I want to do this project. But does it align with the community priorities?
Exactly. Yes.
We'll help you with your research. But how is it going to add value to our processes? You want us to put a focus group discussion for you? We'll do it for you. But we will question, how is this helpful to us?
Exactly.
So whatever we are doing, let's not do research for the sake of research. Can we challenge ourselves? And communities will challenge you.
Yes.
Can you challenge you? Can with this report will help you collect or do or something or research or project or paper.
Yep.
Yes, you'll publish your nice report in a glossy university magazine. But for us, how will this fit in? If it's the challenge of sanitation, how will this your research fit in? How will it add importance and value to our advocacy strategy?
Exactly. And so
that is the question we'll ask you.
You can help to inform.
Number two. Number two. It's how, yes, you'll come do research. So committees will challenge you. We'll help you with your research. But please don't tell us, don't give us the usual crap we get from everybody who comes here. Tell us something we don't know.
Exactly.
Is what we challenge the, our academia when we are doing Mukuru SPA. Please don't give us the usual crap. Tell us, give us something new, something we can use.
Exactly.
And they exactly did that.
Yes.
They went down. Don't tell us, oh, people come from the rural, they migrate, they find space, they build. Can you go deeper and tell us, how do they acquire these spaces?
Yes.
Whom do they go to see?
Yes.
How much do they pay?
And that way, you pushing on the design of the questions, what's their value, what meaning will they have, it pushes the research into new agendas.
New agendas. Let us, and beyond that, let us develop the tool with you.
Exactly.
Let us develop the questionnaire with you.
Exactly.
We'll help you ask the right questions.
Exactly. And so, you know, that value add that you're bringing, of course, with your knowledge, with your ability to say, this is what we know, this is where the field is at, it can push research in much more productive directions. One of my favorite questions, you know, I think for all of, in every line of work, you know, what is your legacy in 1 year, in 5 years?
My legacy, very personal. I'm at very good space where now we have trained a lot of young community activists. We have trained a lot of young student planners who are coming. So the professional angle, I'm covered. So my personal legacy is the youth space and the documentation work that they are doing and the filmmaking work they are doing is I want to create for them spaces. Because when they are doing, we have limited space in our offices. So I want my personal to get spaces for them in informal settlements. We have people now who are turning these container, freight containers.
Very cool.
Into very cool spaces for working.
Yes, yes.
So why don't they, we create all, every informal settlements, let's have two, let's not not let's not even call it a resource center. They'll find a cool name for it.
Yes, exactly.
But get people who will make it so nice
that
young people will want to hang out there.
Totally.
They can do their editing there. I have one big computer that, and so when they want to edit, I have Google people who have provided cameras and. But they are not enough. So I want to personally make sure by the time I leave this space, that there'll be a container in each settlement of young people. And how do I make these containers sustainable?
Yes. Yes. And that is the new knowledge production too, right?
Exactly.
The kind of the know your city, the different types of narratives and experiences that are
exactly.
known.
Exactly. It's to change, the exact word you have used, is to change the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We don't want another Kibera story.
Exactly. Yes.
We want to change. And it's if you look at the whole process, changing their narrative, changing people's attitude. The other thing we are also seeing, young people are challenging us. We also want to decolonize how monitoring is done, how evaluation is done.
Mm-hmm.
We have our own tools to measure mm-hmm. if it was impactful.
Yes.
We have stories. We can capture stories. We can tell stories
mm-hmm.
of the impact.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'll share with you some of the videos. I'll show you several videos of the young people have made.
Yes, exactly.
You see, I look at, we have a small fund that we are giving groups who are doing climate change work.
Mm-hmm.
It's small money, it's $500. But they tell you, look at what we are able to do with this. And so they are making those stories of change
yes.
themselves. And for me, these stories are more powerful than getting somebody from New York to mm-hmm. come and do M&D,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. listen to these stories.
Exactly.
And so that is kind of something I'm personally working on.
So the last question that I want to ask you, and we ask of all of our guests on the mm-hmm. podcast, is what are you reading that you would like to share with our listeners? It could be a novel, poetry, academic, practitioner works. What are you reading? Yes.
So I carry this with me, Khalil Gibran.
Yes.
I read the works of Khalil Gibran.
The Prophet.
Now I'm reading The Prophet. Mm-hmm. He's a Palestinian writer. So this I bought in New York.
Mm.
But now what I'm studying
mm-hmm.
is this. For anybody who wants to understand, it's called The No-Nonsense Guide to Climate Change, The Science, The Solutions, and The Way Forward.
Yes.
You know why I bought it?
Why?
Climate change, some years ago, was a scientific discussion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Before it became a social discussion.
Yes.
Before it became, because people are realizing now this is not no longer scientific. Yeah. They warned us,
mm-hmm.
but now it's here with us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's to keep me. I use the knowledge here mm-hmm. when I talk to young people. I right. tell them this is
by Danny Chivers, is it?
By Danny Chivers.
Yes, yes.
So this is what I'm reading
to help inform social change.
To help inform social change mm-hmm. around climate
mm-hmm.
change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
thank you.
I'm thankful the college for having me here.
We're so glad you're here and be well. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Ufahamu Africa. You can find more episodes, show notes, and transcripts on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. This podcast is produced and managed by Megan DeMint, with help from production assistants Chukwufunanya Ikechukwu, Alex Kozak, and Ami Tamaklo. Our non-resident podcast fellows are Bamba Njaye, Maseke Rioba, Takona Priscilla Sempere, and Kamohelo Tuniko Toledi. We are generously supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and receive research assistance from Cornell University and the University of California, Riverside. Our music is courtesy of Kevin McLeod. Until next week, Safiri Salama.